Hello and welcome to this podcast series, Global Mobility Emerging Trends, from Think Global People and Relocate Global. And the topic for today is family support and the impact of the cost of living crisis. I'm Fiona Murchie, the managing editor and founder of Relocate Global and Think Global People. And I'm here today with Dr. Sue Shortland. She's senior lecturer in HRM at the University of Westminster and also holds the honorary title of Professor Emerita at London Metropolitan University. She's a chartered fellow of the Institute of Personnel and Development and a senior fellow of the Higher Education Academy. She's an active researcher and has published widely in academic journals and practitioner publications. She's also the author of 5 books in the field of HRM. Prior to working in higher education, Sue worked in a managerial consultancy role in international HR at KPMG and managed the CBI Employee Relocation Council. So Sue, welcome and thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, hello Fiona, it's good to be here.
So I think this is going to be a very interesting topic. We're talking about family support and the cost of living crisis and how the global mobility market is changing and responding to that, but also the effect of cost of living on employees and their families. So Sue, let's get started. So why do you think companies need to encourage diversity and understand intersectionality, for example?
Well, there's a strong business case for diversity, Fiona, because it brings in different perspectives, different ideas, and it's very helpful to business if they have a workforce that is sort of representative of their wider market and, you know, their various sort of customer profiles and so on. So there's always a strong business case to have diversity. And it's important to ensure that you have as wide a spectrum as possible of people who are willing to undertake and able to undertake global mobility roles, such that they're able to bring their different perspectives and ideas into that field of an organization's business. So, yes, it's very important indeed. And the other thing is there's a social aspect to it in the sense of celebrating difference, you know, part of the ESG agenda, the sort of social side, a moral duty as well to ensure that everybody plays a role, plays an active role, plays an active part and so on. So typically we tend to think about diversity in terms of personal characteristics. So we tend to think about gender, race, ethnicity, religion, disability, sexual orientation, those kind of aspects that you see covered in the protected characteristics legislation, for example, in the Equality Act in the UK. But it is also important to think of diversity more widely, I think. So I think it's important to think about aspects such as informational diversity and values diversity, because people can bring different informational backgrounds and different values to their workplace, and that plays a part in determining, you know, creativity and innovation within organizations. So that's the first point, really, about sort of celebrating the differences and the business case for diversity. But I think it's also important, as you mentioned, intersectionality, is that people come to work with a whole range of different characteristics. They don't just come, you know, representing a gender or an ethnicity or a religion or whatever. They come with a whole mix of different aspects. And that's where intersectionality comes in. Because intersectionality is really saying, well, a person's contribution is kind of more than the sum of the parts. So intersectionality recognises disadvantage that people might suffer by bringing to the workplace a whole range of different protected characteristics that typically might suffer disadvantage in the workplace. So it's about bringing you know, your thoughts together, really, as to how you can support different people with all the individual characteristics that they might bring to the workplace, in order that you include them effectively, listen to them, and that they can play a full and active part in making your business a success.
Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly recent term. It's a sectionality that people have used, and it makes things sound more complex. But basically, in this perspective, global mobility, it's about who is asked to, say, work internationally and go on an international assignment, for example. Is that correct?
Well, the intersectionality actually goes back a very, very long way. It actually goes back to some work from academics, that were looking at sort of the intersection of gender and race in the American workplace back, decades ago, actually, dates back to the work of Kimberly Crenshaw. It's quite an old term, and it's looked at that, how disadvantage can compound if you bring different characteristics to the workplace, like black women suffered more disadvantage in the workplace than white women and black men, for example. But in terms of where you say it's a recent term, it's coming to the fore now, particularly within research and within the global mobility industry, because there's now a recognition that people can't just be slotted into easy to define groups, and that they bring a range of different characteristics to the workplace. And that if you really want a diversity and inclusion policy that is effective, you need to consider the different characteristics that people bring to the workplace. But yes, in terms of selection for global mobility, for example, you're looking beyond just saying, okay, well, traditionally, expatriates are male and we need more women. And you're looking to say, well, actually, traditionally, expatriates are white men with accompanying spouses and accompanying children. But that's not the case today. It's changing significantly. And you've got a much wider range of people going on assignments from different ethnicities, different religions, different sexual orientations, so on and so forth. And it's about thinking about their individual circumstances and providing family support that will actually assist them to take up an assignment, and ensuring that any selection criteria that you use are inclusive and enable you to select from as wide a pool as possible in order to increase your sort of talent base.
And of course, in times of severe skill shortages, that's increasingly important.
Absolutely. I mean, what makes companies competitive today is the talent that they employ. It's always been the mantra that your human resource is your most important asset, but companies often just pay lip service to that. They can't afford to do that anymore. It's absolutely crucial now that they do look after their human resources, and they have as wide a range of talent as possible, and that they are able to attract and motivate and retain that talent.
Absolutely. And just for the information of our listeners here, we've got a very informative series of fact sheets on various topics, including diversity, equity, inclusion, and talent management, and policy and supporting families. So people can read up more on the technical side as well. So back over to global mobility then. How does this require coordination, communication, perhaps, and efficiencies between the various stakeholders, both internal and external? So what's different, what's changed across global mobility?
I think there's always been the same range of stakeholders. There have always been, the employee who is potentially going on the assignment, the family that is disrupted by going or staying behind or, implicated in some way in the assignment itself. There's always been the sending manager from the home country, the receiving manager from the host country, and then the workforce, the host workforce, that has to accept the person who is coming in there, typically to manage them. And then there's always the top management that are looking for the payback on this, the return on investment. So in a way, these stakeholders have always been there. I think what's changed is the fact that there's now an increased recognition that you have to have coordination between them, and you have to have good communication as well, because you can't just treat one group of stakeholders in isolation. If you're going to if you like, for example, just throw money at a problem and try to just pay employees and their families more, that doesn't necessarily make the assignment more effective or more efficient. It just might cost you more. So it's a question of how you're actually going to communicate with employees and line managers that policy is important, that they need to follow policy, that they need to ensure that the correct support is given and it's done in a cost-effective way. And it is about coordinating all those involved as well. So you've not only got all those sort of internal sort of stakeholders and the external stakeholders in terms of the family, but also all the service industry people who help support families on the move, ranging from different sort of education providers for schools for children, home search providers who help find accommodation for families, relocation management companies who will often take on a whole range of different aspects of the move itself, removals companies, so on and so forth. So there's a whole raft of these different external stakeholders who need to be involved and actually understand what your company is aiming to achieve, both strategically and operationally.
And of course, as we discussed in the first podcast of this series, which was about hybrid and remote working, particularly, compliance and risk are extremely important, and companies have to be very mindful of those. And the relocation companies, the global mobility professionals, are really the guardians of compliance in this respect. So there can be serious consequences if the stakeholders aren't all aligned.
Oh, very true. I mean, the thing is, you've got issues to do with sort of tax liabilities, both individual and corporate tax. You've got, issues to do with immigration and visas and so on and so forth. So, you know, you can't just send an employee abroad and not have the correct visas in place. Dual career couples where the accompanying partner is going as well also is probably going to require a visa in order to work. You can't just send people abroad and just hope that this will fall into place. It does have to be organised carefully and properly and ensure that there is strong coordination between everybody involved and everybody understands the risks that could befall either an individual and or the organization if you get it wrong. So yes, those the compliance issues are very important indeed. And that draws sort of issues of technology into the frame as well. You know, the idea that you need to ensure that you've got everything recorded and monitored and that you're using appropriate technology to track individuals so you actually know where they are and how long they are in particular destinations.
And of course, there's been a rise in promoting employee engagement. And I suppose there sometimes can be a bit of a conflict between the compliance things that employees have to do and getting those messages across, as well as the other messages regarding how valued they are as employees. And of course, those messages also have to feed back to the family as well that are potentially going on an assignment.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think during the pandemic, people have got used to doing remote working and they like doing that and feel that, well, why can't I carry on doing this wherever I want to be? And that's a message that is, you know, has to be got across, that while you want to motivate people and you want to retain talent, you have to do it in a compliant way. And, you know, some of the things that employees and their families might want to do just might not be allowable under law, and if it's not, it's not. And employers have to make sure that that message goes across, but it's got to be communicated in a way that isn't demotivational. It's got to be communicated in a way that is positive.
And just a little bit more on the various service provisions that are provided for employees and families as well. Just to recap for people, policies, there's a lot more of menu items nowadays. Perhaps you could just briefly, I know we've covered that in previous podcasts, but it might be just useful for people just to understand the change there has been in going from policies that are applicable to everyone to a more bespoke approach.
Yes, I think you know, traditionally there have been policies in place that set a framework, and they were strictly adhered to, or the idea was they were meant to be strictly adhered to, so that the employees knew what they were going to get, and the costs could be worked out in advance, you know, cost projections could be done and so on. And the idea was that both the receiving managers and the sending managers stuck to the policy and people got what was written down. But the issue today, you talk about a menu approach, there's much more flexibility in policy, but that's very much reflecting this idea of diversity and intersectionality. It sort of brings it back full circle, if you like, to where we started, in the sense that a standard menu is not necessarily appropriate for everybody. And if you feel you have to ask for an exception to policy, that might put you off going to start with. It might be a bit demotivating, and it might mean that people who could put themselves forward for an assignment or be interested in going abroad feel that it's not appropriate for them because the policy doesn't seem to support their individual needs. So as a result, we are seeing a lot more sort of a menu driven approach with a lot more flexibility. But nonetheless, there has to be a cost framework, you know, overarching umbrella, if you like, that ensures that the costs can still be managed effectively. So as I said, it's not about throwing money at a problem. It's about considering how you best tailor the support to the individual needs and ensuring that individuals who come with these different characteristics feel that they are supported by what is being offered to them.
Excellent, thank you. So over to the second part, the impact of the cost of living pressures on employees and their families. I mean, we know in the UK these have been huge, but perhaps you could just provide an overview of how this can be accommodated, do you think, individually?
Yes, I mean, we're seeing, we know from the press reports that are in the UK, but also from data that's available for rental markets across the world in sort of major cities, that rental charges are rising quite significantly, and that there are rental property shortages. And that's in many, many parts of the world. We often hear about, you know, properties that are being turned into sort of like holiday lets or sort of short term sort of rental lets, rather than being available for individuals to rent longer term. And that's often because the legal framework that governs what landlords are able to do is tightens up, and that might put landlords off, renting longer term. So, yes, the market is sort of shrinking in terms of what's available to rent, and the costs are rising, a sort of typical demand and supply equation, I guess. So in terms of what this means for international assignees, obviously they are competing with locals as well in the marketplace. And that means it can be quite difficult for them. They're trying to do this from abroad. They're trying to do it in a market that they don't know. They don't understand what the legal requirements might be in the country where they're going to. So it does become quite sort of pressurized and sort of quite stressful for them to be able to find appropriate accommodation in a short time scale that meets their budgets. So yes, definitely spiraling costs, too few properties, and a lot of competition going on out there between individuals who are looking for properties to rent.
And so this puts the onus on the, if they're provided with support through a destination service provider or home search consultant, this puts a pressure on those people to be able to explain and communicate to the employees that they're probably not going to get accommodation in the areas they thought they were going to do, or they might need to do trade-offs between property and schooling if they're a family.
Yes, that's right, sadly. Obviously, people with families do want to be near to appropriate schools. I mean, you can't have young children commuting large distances, but that could actually put a lot of pressure on the market local to that particular school, international schools, for example, because everybody's competing for the same properties in a shrinking market close to where you need particular facilities. So it does really put an emphasis to a greater extent, I think, on the support that can be given by experts in the field. So the home search agents, for example, who have got quite good links into sort of property market suppliers and so on, that can be quite helpful for individuals. But yes, you're right. You can't have everything you want these days. And it might mean that there are trade-offs that are needed in terms of where you have to live, or indeed the standard or type or size of accommodation that you're able to rent according to the budgets that have been set for you.
And then there are tables or information that employers use on cost of living allowances. Can you just explain what those are?
Oh, yes. Yes, there are a lot of data providers out there that provide like shopping baskets of information that will actually tell you what a typical shopping basket would be. And from that, there are cost of living sort of data available that organisations can use to work out how much they should be giving employees and families towards making up extra costs of moving to a more expensive location in terms of buying goods and services. And typically there are, you know, different indices that can be used. There's a what's called a standard cost of living index that really replicates your home country spending. And that means it's usually quite expensive for employers to provide cost of living support based on that. Because obviously, if you're trying to replicate what you buy at home, you haven't necessarily got the same types of goods or branded goods or whatever available. So more recently, I think companies use what's called an efficient purchaser index. And that effectively reflects what local people spend. So it's sort of a more local approach to shopping. But the issue for assignees and their families is when they first come into a new location, they don't necessarily know where the, you know, most effective prices are going to be. They don't know what the cheaper shops are going to be. So it's easy to make mistakes and spend more than you need to. And with sort of spiraling inflation, that's obviously a problem for families, really. That said, it means that employers need, again, to communicate very clearly why they're giving an efficient purchaser rather than a standard index, and recognizing that employees might not know where the cheapest places are to shop to start with might mean that either they need some support with information to know where to go, or indeed potentially to have perhaps a slightly increased budget to begin with, just while they settle in for the first few weeks and get used to what's available in their local area.
And again, this is another area where technology is helping employers to do this by surveying all the time. And there are great advances on platforms that can provide the information that is equally available to the employees going on an assignment nowadays.
Yes, but obviously employers have to sort of subscribe to the platform. So again, you know, there's different ways that they can provide the support. It's all going to cost something, you know, whether you're employing a home search provider to actually advise on your shopping in local areas and sort of where it's more cost efficient, whether you're using a technology platform, whether you're buying data, so on and so forth. But it's still important to be thinking about these issues, because employees will struggle really to start with, and their productivity is likely to fall. So if you've got a cost benefit analysis in place, you can work out whether, you know, the cost of the support that you're giving will reap dividends in terms of the productivity from the employee and the happiness of the family. And I know it sounds odd to say happiness of the family because it's difficult to measure it. But what will happen is if the family is unsettled and really unhappy where they are, it will affect employee productivity. And as a result, it could even end in the assignment being cancelled and the employee and family wanting to go home if they can't find suitable housing and they feel it's too expensive and, you know, they're too far away from local schools. And all these issues can make a big difference as to whether the assignment is successful or not.
Yes. And of course, dual career couples as well. That's another impact, isn't it?
The issue with dual career couples is often what you have is people are reliant on two incomes, and quite often people who are in good careers are partnered or married to others in good careers. And, you know, when one partner is moved abroad, there is a question as to whether it's affordable for the couple to move if one of them has to give up their job and cannot get a suitable role in the overseas location. And also the issue of sort of career breaks, what damage it does long term to the partner's career if they're not able to work. So certainly dual careers can act as a brake on mobility. And again, any support that employers can give in terms of assisting dual career partners, for example, to secure appropriate work visas, or put them in touch with other employers who might be able to offer them work, help them with career counselling, CV or resume preparation. All these kinds of aspects of support are helpful for dual career couples.
So in summary, Sue, where do you think we are with coping with the cost of living pressures?
I think employers are, you know, doing reasonably well with respect to their assignee populations. I think it's important that what they do is they review their practices regularly. So if you do provide a sort of a cost of living allowance, just make sure that it's reviewed regularly, potentially more often than you might have done in the past. You know, when inflation just wasn't really doing anything for years, organisations might have looked at their cost of living allowances annually or twice a year. Now it's important to look at it more regularly, perhaps quarterly, for example. So I think employers, provided they are actually committed to family support and think about it in terms of the pressures that are on families, both in terms of housing and in terms of the direct costs of moving, I think that, you know, they can support the families who are moving quite well.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very, very much indeed. So that's been a wonderful roundup of the implications for families and for the employers as well on the cost of living. So thank you very much, Sue, for joining us today.
You're welcome, Fiona. Thank you.
And there's plenty more helpful advice and supporting content written by Dr. Sue Shortland on the website relocateglobal.com, as well as, we mentioned before, various fact sheets. So thank you very much for joining us. And please do look at the other podcasts in the series and watch out for our International Education and Schools Fair for more information and support for families on the move. Thank you very much.